Clements, Director of the Tota Peace Institute, and it gives me and my colleague, Dr. Mukherjee, great pleasure in welcoming Professor Kazuo Matsushita to this public conversation on global environmental challenges for the 21st century. I can't think of a person better qualified to talk to us about these issues than Kazuo. He's a professor emeritus at Kyoto University, the chairman of the Japan Society for GNH Studies, senior fellow Institute for Global Environmental Strategies, and co-chair of Think7 Japan 2023. He's had a very, very distinguished career as an environmental policymaker in Japan at the OECD and the UN Conference on Environment and Development. So welcome, Kazuo, to this conversation. I'd also like to welcome my colleague and the lead researcher on TOTA's Climate Change and Conflict Program, Dr. Volker Bogi. So welcome to both of you. To get the ball rolling, Kazuo, can you tell us a little bit about your background in environmental studies, environmental administration, and environmental policies, and when you first became interested in climate change and why?
Okay. Thank you very much, Kevin. And thank you very much for inviting this dialogue. Thinking back about your question, my college years from the late 1960s to the early 1970s were a period of rapid economic growth in Japan. The economy continued to grow at an annual rate of around 10%, and it was regarded as a Japanese miracle. However, despite the economic growth, serious industrial pollution occurred, and Japan suffered from the most serious pollution in the world. These include, you may know, Minamata disease, Yokkaichi air pollution, and photochemical smogs caused by automobiles. I was studying economics at the university, and I thought if quantitative economic growth does not make people happy, what is the economy for? In 1972, Global Brown issued a shocking report entitled The Limit to Growth. In Japan, the Environment Agency was established in 1971 as the government agency in charge of combating growing pollution and protecting the environment. I joined the newly established Environment Agency in 1972 as a first career senior employee after graduating from the university. Since joining the Environment Agency, I have been involved in various environmental issues and environmental administration. During that time, in the early 90s, I was seconded to the Environment Bureau of the OECD headquartered in Paris, where I had the opportunity to get a bird's eye view of environmental policies and measures, mainly in developed countries, from an international perspective. Japan, which experienced serious industrial pollution, subsequently made progress in pollution countermeasures through government regulation, the technological response by industry, and investment in pollution prevention. And later, during the oil crisis, took the most advanced energy-saving measures in the world. As a result, Japan came to be recognized worldwide as an advanced country in pollution technology and energy conservation. So problems such as ozone layer depletion, acid rain, and tropical forest destruction began to attract attention with global warming and climate change in particular became major issues. In 1992, the UN Conference on Environment and Development, also known as the Earth Summit, was to be held in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. I was dispatched after the onset from the government of Japan to work as a senior environmental planning officer at the UNCED Secretariat. Sustainable development as its basic concept, United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change and Convention on Biodiversity were negotiated and adopted in the process of the Earth Summit. So I became deeply involved in global environmental issues such as climate change and development issues in developing countries. After UNCED, I returned to the Environment Agency again, this time as a director in charge of climate change issues and involved in domestic measures as well as international negotiations related to the Climate Change Convention and Kyoto Protocol. So this is how I was involved with climate change. The IPCC was established in 1988, and the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change was adopted in 1992. So it has been more than 30 or 35 years now.
Oh, thank you very much for a very comprehensive response. And you've described exactly why we want to have this public conversation with you. Incidentally, I can remember pollution in Japan in 1970, and it was very unpleasant. And so I congratulate you and your countrymen for dealing with pollution so dramatically over the 70s and 80s. Over to you, Volker.
Yeah, thank you, Professor Matsushita. And this was very amazing to see that you started work on environmental issues when they became a policy topic in the early 1970s, and that you've been involved in this work for more than three decades now. It's fascinating. And as I understand it, currently you are talking in your publications about triple global crises. Can you elaborate a little bit on that? What do you mean by triple global?
Triple global crises include climate change, pollution, and biodiversity loss. The three planetary crises are closely interlinked, related, and drive further damage to the environment and to our health. And behind these crises lie the fact that our economic activities, that is, the way we consume and produce, have become unsustainable. And the globalization of the economy have sort of accelerated the problems further seriously.
Thank you.
You're also advocating for a radical economic and social shift to a non-fossil fuel civilization. Can you tell us a little bit about what that encompasses, and what do you see as the chances for such a radical shift?
Actually, this is necessary from two perspectives. One is from the perspective of combating climate change. The other is from the perspective of the energy transition for peace, as demonstrated by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. From the perspective of combating climate change, in order to achieve the goal sought by the Paris Agreement, that is to limit the increase in global temperatures since the Industrial Revolution to less than 1.5 degrees centigrade, we must become carbon neutral, that is, achieve net zero anthropogenic greenhouse gas emissions at least by the year 2050. This means getting rid of our dependence on fossil fuels. In other words, we have to move away from a fossil fuel-based dependent civilization. And next is the significance of the energy transition for peace. Most of the world's conflicts in recent years, if you remember, have been over fossil fuel interests. Fossil fuels are unevenly distributed in certain regions of the globe, and conflicts over their use occur frequently. On the other hand, renewable energy sources, such as solar and wind, are ubiquitous throughout the world. This is why it is said there are wars over oil, but no wars on the sun. So therefore, in order to build a peaceful world, we need to break away from fossil fuel civilization. In fact, the Pacific Island nations, such as Vanuatu and Tuvalu, are advocating to agree on the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty. And also the IEA, International Energy Agency, in its report, Net Zero by 2050, states that it is necessary and possible to decarbonize the energy. The necessary technologies and means are already in place. the price of renewable energy is falling rapidly. So the money is there. The problem is one of political will to move away from a civilization dependent on fossil fuels.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you. And of course, this shift to non-fossil fuel civilization is a global challenge. But actors like Japan, I think, have a particular responsibility as highly industrialized countries. So let's zoom in a little bit into what's going on in Japan. You also talk about Japan as a decarbonized society, and you have this vision for a transition to a zero carbon Japan. Can you elaborate a little bit on that, what this really implies, what the intermediate and follow-up steps should be, and which kind of stakeholders should be involved?
Yeah, the first step that is necessary is to expand renewable energy and further promote energy conservation. So this requires a combination of regulations and economic incentives. An important method is carbon pricing. We need to introduce full-scale effective carbon pricing as soon as possible. In addition, local initiatives involving all stakeholders in the region for decarbonization are important. In order to expand renewable energy, effective measures and regulatory reforms are required to accelerate the introduction of renewable energy, such as accelerating the development of in Japan, there is a very big potential for floating offshore wind turbines and making an installation for the photovoltaic power generation. It is necessary to make PV mandatory for new buildings. And in addition, it is necessary to improve the power transmission network and develop and diffuse storage batteries and accelerate the diffusion of EVs, electric vehicles. These are some of the necessary measures. Some people say that renewable energy have fluctuations, so we have to increase the ability to adjust to the volatility of renewable energies. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm very pleased that you're addressing all of these issues, Kazuo. They're absolutely key to combating climate change. In this context, can you elaborate a bit on your ideas for a net zero city, especially when you're thinking about a city the size of Tokyo, or a net zero lifestyle?
Yeah. Let me start by telling my story regarding the net zero lifestyle. I live in a well-insulated house with solar panels on the roof. I also have a household fuel cell system that effectively provides me with hot water and electricity. I don't own a car now and get around mostly on foot or by public transportation. So now is the cherry blossom season. I enjoy walking around the neighborhood. This way of life is the result of my choice, but there are several social conditions that have made it possible. For example, the introduction of solar panels was made possible by the introduction of a so-called feed-in tariff system, FIT, F-I-T, which is a system under which electric power companies purchase electricity generated from solar panels at favorable prices. And there are subsidies and also available for household fuel cells. And I don't have to own a car because the public transportation system in Yokohama and Tokyo, where I live and work, is well maintained. So I do not believe that we should require individuals to sacrifice comfort and convenience in pursuit of a net zero lifestyle, because if you sacrifice too much, it won't be sustainable. It is more important to change the social system so that people can enjoy a net zero lifestyle. So you need a kind of enabling conditions for net zero lifestyle. For example, if you want to ride a bicycle, safe and comfortable bicycle lanes are necessary for safe and comfortable bicycle riding. That's the same goes for pedestrian sidewalks and improved public transportation. Also, stricter standards for better installation of households and mandatory installation of solar panels on households should also be promoted. We also need to make our cities themselves greener, more comfortable, more environmentally friendly, and more compact. So while it is important to review one's own lifestyle, it is more important to raise the voices necessary to change the social system, to change politics, and to change policies.
Yes, that's really impressive, your personal approach to getting to a net zero lifestyle. But you also mentioned that the conditions have to be established for that when you talk about public transport or bike lanes and so forth, which in the country where I live at the moment in Australia is really a big challenge. So governments also have a responsibility here. So let's talk about the Japanese government. So the former Prime Minister Suga in 2020 declared that Japan will be carbon neutral by 2050. But what's the position of the new Prime Minister Kishida, and what does the Japanese government actually do to achieve this goal?
Thank you very much. I appreciate very much the former Prime Minister Suga's declaration to achieve net zero emission by 2050. However, it can be said that the current Japanese government is taking necessary plans and measures to achieve this goal. For example, let me share the agreement reached last year's G7 summit in Germany. At last year's G7 summit, it was agreed to phase out coal-fired power plants without emission reduction measures. And all G7 member countries, except Japan, have specified a time frame for phasing out coal-fired power generation by 2035 at the latest. Japan is now the only G7 member country that has not specified when it will phase out coal-fired power plants. According to the Japanese Energy Basic Plan, Japan still rely on coal-fired power plants 20% by 2030 out of the total energy electricity sources. And it was also agreed to decarbonize most of the electricity sector by 2035 after last year's G7 summit. And all G7 member countries, except Japan, have specified pathways to decarbonize most of the electricity sector by 2035. So Japan is the only country that has not set a domestic goal or decarbonization plan by 2035 and has not yet prepared a roadmap to achieve it. So in order for Japan to confront the energy and climate crisis, it is indispensable to expand the use of renewable energy to bring the country's electricity supply up to a level comparable to other G7 countries by 2035, and to quickly implement the specific policies, systems, and regulatory reforms necessary to achieve this goal.
We're very privileged to have you here because of your very close proximity with the Japanese government policies on these issues. What's your assessment of the government of Japan's GX green transformation basic policy and the GX promotion bill approved by the cabinet in February?
Yeah, actually, this bill is under deliberation in the parliament now in Japan. But as far as I understand, the green transformation basic policy approved by the Japanese government in February this year does not include any specifics on a path to decarbonize all or most of Japan's electricity by sector by 2035. In order to realize such significant reduction of CO2 emissions and the G7 agreement to decarbonize Japan's power sources by 2035, it is, I repeat, this indispensable for Japan to accelerate the introduction of renewable energy sources, which are already at the practical stage and whose costs are declining in Japan. But still, the share of renewable energy in Japan is only 20%, while it is over 40% in Germany or the UK and in other countries. And although our Green Transformation Basic Plan calls for making renewable energy the main source of power, the target for the introduction of renewable energy remains 36 to 38% in fiscal year 2030, with no mention of 2035. And on the other hand, Green Transformation Basic Policy includes such things as co-firing of ammonia and hydrogen with thermal power generation. And in my view, and in many experts' view, which would not contribute to the reduction of CO2 and would result in the continued existence of existing coal-fired power plants and could be criticized as greenwashing. So I hope to see a positive approach that truly contribute to decarbonization. The Japanese government has indicated that it intends to introduce carbon pricing, but the carbon levy will not be introduced until fiscal year 2028. The emission trading system will remain voluntary for the next 10 years. So there's no provision requiring the participation of business sites and business above a certain standard, which is essential for an international standard emission trading system. And there's no provision for total reduction in the amount of carbon emissions by the targeted sites and businesses. And also the level of carbon price plans to be introduced is estimated to be only 1/10 of the IEA, International Energy Agency's proposal. That is a carbon price of $130 per ton in 2030. So the carbon pricing that is planned to be introduced is too late, too little. So yes. If nothing is done, there is a risk that the voluntary system that deviates from the international standards will become entrenched. So in order for Japan to confront energy and the climate crisis, it is indispensable to expand the use of renewable energy to bring countries' electricity supply up to a level comparable to other G7 countries by 2035, and to quickly implement the specific policies, systems, and regulatory reform necessary to achieve this goal.
Thank you.
That's really disappointing what you have to say about the Japanese government policy here. So it looks like Japan is really a climate laggard when it comes to government policies. But can you maybe say something more positive about, for instance, business in Japan? And is there maybe more going on when you look at big business, and are they more open to your vision of it? Of a transition to a zero carbon Japan than the Japanese government?
Yeah, as you have pointed out, even though the Japanese government is a bit lagging behind, there are some initiatives by some industries or local municipalities and civil society, so-called non-state actors. And actually, currently, the core of Japan's climate and energy policy is determined through consultation between the government, particularly Ministry of Economy, Trade and Industry, METI, and the major companies of the Keidanren, Japan's biggest business association, which is centered on the heavy and chemical industries, including electric power, steel, and energy. So it tends to lean towards the protection of conventional or vested interests, business interests. As a result, Japan's dependence on fossil fuels has continued, and the expansion of renewable energy and the introduction of carbon pricing has been delayed. But industry, however, is not monolithic. There is a growing group of companies that are calling for proactive climate change action. For example, the organization that has thus embraced this cooperation is the Japan Climate Initiative, JCI. This organization covers nearly 600 companies and members of this of the JCI now. If I may, I would like to quote their message. The Japan Climate Initiative invites all non-state actors in Japan, including businesses, local governments, NGOs, and organizations, to endorse the following message. JCI will seize this opportunity to call on the Japanese government to further strengthen its climate measures and to send a joint message to the world to convey the efforts of Japanese companies, local governments, NGOs, and other organizations. We are Japanese non-state actors, including companies, local governments, NGOs, and other participating in the Japan Climate Initiative, call on the Japanese government to reduce dependence on fossil fuels such as coal and overcome the two crises by accelerating the deployment of renewable energy and introducing effective carbon pricing as soon as possible. We will also take the lead in taking action. We believe that Japan should and can play a greater role in the global effort to overcome the climate crisis. We at JCI are committed to pioneering emission reduction and deepening collaboration among non-state actors in Japan and abroad to serve as a bridge between Japan and the rest of the world. End quote. Thank you.
Thank you. A lot of what you've been talking about in relation to carbon pricing and so forth and net zero lifestyles, etc., depends on energy security. So how can energy security be guaranteed, especially in a world where something like the war in Ukraine, for example, suddenly places a big question mark over such security?
I think energy security in the face of Russia's invasion in Ukraine have different aspects for the short-term and long-term impacts. But basically, the ways to improve energy security include first, increase domestically produced energy. In other words, expand, in the case of Japan and many countries, renewable energy as much as possible. And second, expand the security and net power grid, secure pumped storage, and develop and deploy storage batteries to mitigate the impact of fluctuation in renewable energy sources. Third, save and improve energy efficiency. Fourth, create a decentralized, locally self-reliant economic structure. Fifth, diversify as much as possible the sources of necessary fossil fuels or import sources. We have to import coal or oil in the near continue to do so, but to diversify as much as possible the sources necessary for the fuels and secure stable imports from other countries. And regarding the nuclear power, it has been pointed out that nuclear power depends on imports of uranium, the fuel for nuclear power, and that uranium is depletable. So in addition, a final disposal site for high-level radioactive waste has not been decided. And furthermore, since Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there is a security threat that nuclear power plants could be the target of an attack in the event of an emergency or in the case of conflicts. So as I said, we have to accelerate the conservation of energy and increase the domestic source of energy, as well as diversify energy sources. So that is the strategy for energy security.
Mm. Yeah, thank you. And again, it's disappointing to learn that obviously in Japan, there are still people thinking that nuclear power could be a solution to the climate crisis. You already mentioned the war in Ukraine, and there are other global issues like the COVID pandemic that also affect climate change policies. And how does this play out in the Japanese context? So the COVID crisis, or the crisis with regard to the war in Ukraine, how does this have an impact on Japanese climate policies?
Yeah, in the short term, these events may impede the path to decarbonization. We have to sometimes revive the generation of power from coal-fired power plants. But I believe that in the long term, it is possible and essential to resolve these crises simultaneously, which is to accelerate the transition to a less pandemic-prone and fossil fuel-dependent society. And as for the Russia's invasion of Ukraine, as you can see, the war is the most destructive form of the environmental and human rights destruction. So the energy crisis accelerated Russia's invasion of Ukraine has made the world keenly aware of the urgency of moving away from dependence on fossil fuels. And the price hike of fossil fuels encouraged countries to move, accelerated the shift towards renewable energies. So the right way to avoid conflicts over fossil fuels, transition to a decarbonized society, and strengthen energy security is to move away from dependence on fossil fuels as soon as possible. So I repeat, the most promising means to achieve this is to promote energy efficiency and conservation on the demand side, and to expand renewable energy on the supply side. Thank you.
Great, thank you. If we can follow up on Volker's question there, going back to the COVID-19 pandemic, when states were able to insist on significant behavioral changes for their citizens, are there any lessons that could be learned from the COVID-19 pandemic for international climate policies?
COVID-19 exposed the fact that the crisis of loss of nature, both COVID-19 and climate change and other environment, has loss of nature has led to the crisis of human survival, and the society and government were not prepared to respond adequately to these crises. And those crises are amplified by social inequality and disparity. The most affected by the pandemic are the socially vulnerable and those living in poverty. So yes, the crisis associated with COVID-19 demonstrated the importance of accurately identifying and preparing for risk based on scientific knowledge. Both COVID-19 and climate change issues are related to the survival of human race and are extremely important issues that the international community should work together to address. From a long-term perspective, we need to make an early transition to a decarbonized and resilient society, a society that is resilient and resistant to natural disasters. That is an economy and society that is resistant to pandemics and able to avoid climate change. So currently, the international community, international society, internationally proposed approach to building a pandemic-resistant society and at the same time avoiding the climate crisis are called green recovery and build back better approach.
Let's turn to more recent developments and events in the climate change policy field now. So let's first look a little bit back into the past. So what's your assessment of the last COP, of COP27?
The agreement that the COP27 last year to establish a loss and damage fund is a major breakthrough. Because for the past 30 years, most vulnerable countries are repeatedly asking for this kind of fund to cover loss and damage. But the details will be discussed later. I mean, have been started to be discussed. So the devil is in the details. So we have to watch carefully what will be discussed within the framework of loss and damage. And on the other hand, there was little progress at COP27 last year to be little progress in strengthening countries' mitigation efforts to raise their ambitions to combat climate change. Thank you.
Japan is going to be hosting the G7 Hiroshima summit this year in May and COP28 later in the year. What are you and your colleagues thinking about in relation to climate change in those particular meetings?
Yeah, as you know, the IPCC published recently the synthesis report, or sixth synthesis report, assessment report. And I think the G7 summit in Hiroshima in May this year have to respond to the message of the IPCC's sixth synthesis report and should agree to immediate intensified reduction of greenhouse gases and increased support for developing countries, and which includes global greenhouse emissions decline by 2025, reduce global emissions in 2030 year, 35 by about 60% from 2019, 69% reduction in 2040, and 84% in 2050. As you know, the UN Secretary General Guterres stated that the needle on the climate time bomb is ticking and called on developed countries to accelerate the achievement of zero real emission by 2040, to phase out new coal-fired power generation and phase out existing coal-fired power plant generation by 2030, to ensure that all developed countries have net zero power generation by 2035, etc. The G7 Hiroshima summit must respond positively to these goals. And as I said earlier, at last year's G7 summit, it was agreed to phase out coal-fired power plants without emission reduction measures. And all G7 members, countries except Japan, have specified a time frame for phasing out coal-fired power generation by 2030 at the latest. And in that sense, Japan is have to work harder. And in order for Japan to confront the energy and climate crisis, Japan has to expand the use of renewable energy and introduce a carbon internationally standard of carbon pricing and quickly implement specific policies and measures.
Yeah, thank you. Let's talk a little bit about regional cooperation in climate policy. It's interesting to see that on the one hand, there are so many deficiencies in the Japanese government's climate change policies at home. But on the other hand, Japan also wants to present itself as a leader in regional climate policy. So at the World Economic Forum in Davos last year in January 2022, the Japanese Prime Minister Kishida declared his vision for an Asia Zero Emissions Community, AZEC. And what do you think about this? Is this just declaratory politics, or is there any substance to this Asia Zero Emission Community?
Thank you very much for raising this issue. So I highly appreciate the intention of the Asian Zero Emission Community initiative that government of Japan initiated. This aims to achieve zero emission through close cooperation with Asian countries. So the problem is, however, is that it's content. In terms of content, I appreciate the fact that the initiatives include such urgent and important measures as the expansion of renewable energy sources, such as wind and solar, cooperation in the development and expansion of storage batteries, and development of power transmission networks. And I hope that these will be promoted. On the other hand, it also includes such things as co-firing of ammonia and hydrogen with thermal power generation, which will not contribute to the reduction of CO2 and would result in the continued existence of existing coal-fired power plants and could be criticized as greenwashing, as I said. So I hope to see a positive approach that truly contribute to the decarbonization and revitalization of the economy within the Asian communities. Thank you.
As a sort of follow-up to that question, in early March this year, there was a meeting of energy ministers and business delegations from ASEC partner states in Tokyo. Was there any progress made at that meeting? It sounds, from what you've been saying, that there was very little.
Yeah, there was a lot of project or MOUs, memorandum understanding were signed between the Japanese power companies and the ASEAN counterparts. In promoting such areas as renewable energy, wind power, solar, as well as other activities, expanding ammonia or green hydro or coal-fired power plants. So there are projects which should be truly positive in terms of CO2 reduction, but so there are some which are more questionable. So we have to see what will be the development.
As you know, the Toda Peace Institute is working closely with colleagues in the Pacific Island countries on issues of climate change and peace. And you already mentioned earlier in this interview the initiative of Vanuatu and Tuvalu aiming for a fossil-free future for the Pacific and globally. Can there be some specific role for Japan? Japan is a member of the Partners in the Blue Pacific Group, together with Australia, New Zealand, and the United Kingdom and the United States. So Japan has, in a way, presented itself as interested in what's going on in the Pacific, also with regard to climate change. What could be the specific role Japan could play?
Yeah, I think, I believe Japan can play a very significant role, or should play a significant role in this area. In particular, Japan can play a major role in For example, providing early warning systems for climate change and adaptation to weather damage and recovery from disasters, disaster recovery, reconstruction, and also infrastructure development and capacity building in terms of scientific knowledge and various technologies. And already cooperation is already underway, for example, through JICA and other organizations. The Climate Change Adaptation Center of the National Institute for Environmental Studies, NIES, provides information analysis and support for adaptation measures, not only in Japan, but also in the Asia-Pacific region through the Asia-Pacific Climate Change Adaptation Information Platform, that is called APPLAT. There are various ways to strengthen cooperation in this area. Thank you.
In some of your publications, Kazuo, you express confidence that, you know, quote, the era of great decarbonization competition has begun. So what indications do you see for such competition, and will that help advance Japan's desire for becoming a kind of a net zero economy and country?
Actually, Japan used to be a very advanced country in terms of, for example, solar power or batteries, but currently solar panels have been dominated by Chinese or Korean or Taiwanese companies. Japanese companies are not very competitive. But if you look at the various indicators, for example, IEA report, net zero by 2050 report, in the net zero pathway by 2030, solar and wind power will quadruple, and electric car sales will be 18 times by 2030, and energy intensity of GDP will improve 40% per year. So the companies and countries that secure dominant position in this rapidly growing decarbonization market will prosper. And as you can see, the automobile is also a very competitive market towards zero emission vehicles.
It's always difficult to make policymakers listen. So there's always this gap between research and the findings of the research and what policymakers do. And what's your personal experience over the last years? Do you have an idea whether your research that you're doing is or is in a way also absorbed by the policymakers? Or what do you think, what could be done from the side of researchers to make policymakers listen more?
Well, I think it is a very difficult question. But as researchers, we have no choice but to make arguments based on sound logic and evidence, and to make proposals based on environmental effectiveness and equity, taking into account of the international discussions. Climate change policy must be based on science. Science is, of course, very diverse. Different sciences has to contribute. And as IPCC indicated, it's a sort of a joint work of various researchers, including natural science and social science. And we have no choice but to pursue fair and effective policies in a straightforward manner. It is important for the academic community to continue to earnestly make policy proposals. And in addition, I think that the decision-making process needs to be reformed. It depends on the country, but a system that reflects diverse opinions representing civil society, and in particular, voices of, for example, women and youth, not just a few industries and government agencies, is needed. And for example, the Climate Citizens Assembly, already method implemented in the UK or in France and other countries, can be used as a reference. Thank you.
Here in New Zealand, Kazuo, climate change question is really being taken up by young people, the next generation, primary and secondary school students and so forth, who have been conducting very large demonstrations up and down the country, especially in relation to the last report. Can you give us some sense of the state of the Japanese environmental movement? And do you think that the next generation of Japanese will live in a decarbonized society?
Japanese society is, populations is aging, but we have to give hope to young people. And I sincerely hope that the next generation of Japanese live in the decarbonized society. And it is important for young people to be able to have a vision of hope for the future of society that they want, and to be able to work toward it, to be an agent for change. So I would like to encourage young people to be a part of a change you want to see in the world. So that is what Mahatma Gandhi said.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Well, we're really at an end, I think. But it gives me very great pleasure in thanking you for all the wonderful contributions to this discussion, but more importantly, all of the contributions you've made to Japanese policy formation and multilateral policy formation in the areas of climate change, environmental protection, species protection, and so forth. Your whole career has been a testimony to the power of evidence and scientific argument, and the way in which those can really make a positive impact on policymakers. And so I just want to thank you for all the work you've done over the course of your long career, and for this wonderful contribution to our public conversation.